This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Given the level of partisan rancor between the two major parties, and honestly, rancor feels like a huge understatement at this point, you would think that the parties share absolutely nothing in common, but that isn't exactly the case. Here are two points of agreement between many Democrats and Republicans: an increasingly hard line toward China and a general suspicion or hostility toward tech companies. So the idea of banning TikTok, which is owned by a Chinese company, is getting real traction in Washington. A ban had been floated during the Trump administration, but at the recent congressional hearing with TikTok's CEO, members of both parties were in full display of performative outrage, even members who wouldn't know TikTok if they saw it on their screens.
So if I have a TikTok app on my phone and my phone is on my home Wi-Fi network, does TikTok access that network?
It will have to access the network to get connections to the internet.
That's not enough for me. That's not enough for the parents of America.
Can you say with 100% certainty that TikTok does not use the phone's camera to determine whether the content that elicits a pupil dilation should be amplified by the algorithm? Can you tell me that?
The Chinese government has that data.
Congresswoman, I have seen no evidence that the Chinese government has access to that data. They have never asked us. We have not provided.
Well, you know what? I find that actually preposterous.
We're going to talk today about the U.S., China, and TikTok. Joining me a little later is our Washington correspondent, Evan Osnos. But I'll start with the journalist, Chris Stokel-Walker.
Chris, where are you? You're in the.
I'm based in Newcastle, England, so I'm 300 miles north of.
Stokel-Walker writes frequently for Wired, and he's the author of two books, YouTubers and TikTok Boom. TikTok's parent company, ByteDance, which of course is Chinese, says it has 150 million users in the United States. Can you give us some context around that number? How much of a hold does that app have on its users?
Yeah, the average user spends pretty much as much time on TikTok in a given day as they do the average feature film exists. So this is kind of like you spend 90 minutes or so on TikTok every day if you are the average TikTok user.
Obviously, okay, time out. 150 million people are spending an hour and a half, 2 hours a day on TikTok?
Yeah, because you get sucked in. Basically, the way that the app is designed is engineered to try and keep you going. So, you know, you open the app, and it is a significantly different experience to lots of other social media platforms. It is full screen. It is immersive. It is vertical video. You are thrown headlong into an endless torrent of videos that scrolls past you without stopping.
Core. What is it? And why is it suddenly taking over TikTok?
It's kind of, you know, the world's cinema playing all of the different genres possible all at once.
Guys, I figured out the reason why I'm single.
There's 10 movies on Netflix that you've never heard of but should totally watch.
This one is an absolute banger. Woodchuck by Huddy.
How much wood would a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck was a bad?
This is what you need to be doing in 2023 to go viral on TikTok. A lot from 2022 has changed, so make sure you lock into this right now.
Roe v. Wade and what happens next in under 60 seconds. The Supreme Court just overturned federal.
Second Earth has just been discovered by NASA. Here's what you need to know.
You're a user of TikTok. What are you particularly enthusiastic about watching, looking at?
I like the fact that you can express yourself much more on TikTok than you can on any other social media platform. I wrote a book on TikTok, but before that, 2 years before that, I wrote a book on YouTube. And I kind of have made it my job to study digital creation, the idea of how you express yourself on the internet in this world, which is increasingly now how you express yourself in life, full stop. Online and offline worlds have blended together for all intents and purposes. In the kind of, you know, 20 plus year history of online creation and online expression, there have been huge barriers to entry. You know, you needed good equipment. You needed good internet connections. You needed good cameras, good microphones. You needed time to edit videos. You needed photogenic looks. You needed to be having a winning personality to sustain an audience over a 10, 15, 20 minute video. TikTok breaks down those barriers, and that is in large reason why it's so successful, why 1.5 billion people worldwide use it, is because the app allows you to just pick up and create. It doesn't require a lot of thinking. It doesn't require a lot of effort. It doesn't require a lot of equipment. It has made creators of all of us, which is good in one way, but bad in another way. But I think more than any other platform that has gone in the past, mm-hmm. it allows us to dip in and out.
Let's get to the politics of this. The main concern that we're hearing from the Biden administration and many members of Congress is security. What is their fear exactly?
Their fear is that TikTok is sending all of your data to China, where it is sucked up and monitored and wiretapped by some Beijing-based spy for the Central Communist Party of China, that essentially they are learning all about you through your habits, through your interests. I personally don't buy it. I think that actually, you know, there are several different angles to this. Number one is, if the Chinese Communist Party was actually interested in your preference for baseball versus football, or your choice of different types of music, or whether you like knock knock jokes, or whether you like carefully constructed, you know, satires on society, it could get that information from any number of other Western social media platforms where you provide exactly the same data. I think that the difference here is one of perception, which is that the app has that inexorable link to China, so much so that, you know, the parent company ByteDance prefers to say they're based in a known tax haven.
But before we're too dismissive of this, it's been shown in previous years that, in fact, American-owned social media has not been such an innocent player at all. So why shouldn't we be suspicious of TikTok, and with the added dimension that it's owned by the Chinese, which, you know, we'll get to in a second with Evan Osnos, who spent a hell of a long time in China. Go ahead, Chris.
I think we should be suspicious of all social media, but I don't think that TikTok is the attack vector that we think it is. I think it's...
How do we know?
Well, we don't, and this is the challenge. How do you disprove a negative? Mm-hmm. You know, it's that classic journalistic question of, when did you last beat your wife? David Remnick, when did you last beat your wife? Mm-hmm. You know, by asking that question in that way, I am supposing and presenting a kind of negative viewpoint of you.
But there is one instance that's been documented of TikTok employees tracking a journalist's data. Mm. It stands out, at least to my innocent ears, as an example of what's possible. If the company is tracking other journalists or politicians, would we ever know for sure what's going on?
No, I don't. And I come to this in a sort of relatively unique position, in that, you know, I am not based in the US. I am not born in the US. I'm 33 years old. I've spent my entire online life living by the rules designed by a small cadre of people in Silicon Valley who think that this is the way that the world should work. And so to me, as an outsider from outside the US, I'd love to say to you all, this is what it's like for the rest of us. You know, you are encountering for the first time what it is like to be the taker of the social norms on these platforms from an entirely different country. And, you know, there are these concerns. You're right. You know, we can't overlook the fact that, you know, this company spied on journalists, which is absolutely abhorrent. We can't also overlook the fact that it is a Chinese company. It has origins in China.
But you're asking us to overlook that fact, aren't you?
No, I'm saying that this is exactly the same as any other platform.
Now, as I understand it, though, the concern is not just the tracking of user data, but the algorithm itself. The idea that TikTok could be used as a sort of propaganda machine favoring opinions sympathetic to China or critical of the U.S.
Yeah, this is one of the interesting pillars of the argument against TikTok and for banning it, which is that the Chinese state could be surreptitiously feeding us pro-China content that could essentially program us to rise up when they choose against our governments and overthrow capitalism in favor of Chinese communism. It is an interesting idea, and we certainly know that state-sponsored propaganda and prompting of users through social media happens. We have lived through the 2016 US presidential election, where Russia was shown to have interfered in our democracy and to have seeded ideas about the way that the US worked through social media platforms like Twitter. And it's that precedent, I think, that nullifies the concerns around TikTok and the idea that this is being seeded with propaganda. Because ultimately, even if we were to ban TikTok and say the Chinese state cannot use those platforms, they do this already on other platforms. We know of state-sponsored interference through Twitter, through Facebook, through Instagram. All of those platforms are used and would be used even if we decided that TikTok couldn't be.
We should also add, just to round out the picture where social media is concerned, Twitter is already banned in China, as are other apps. How come the Chinese banned Twitter and those other apps?
I mean, they banned it because they dislike the idea of free speech, which is what's so curious about the push to ban TikTok now, is it seems ironically quite Chinese to kind of crack down on something because we're worried about it. And we're worried about the kind of content that is shared on it.
So on one hand, the Chinese are worried about social media from abroad for free speech reasons. We're worried about it for surveillance state reasons.
Yeah, and I think it is interesting to see that we're going down that line, because TikTok has been banned in other countries before. In India, they banned it in June 2020 over a border dispute with China, where the government at the time in India said, you know, we are banning this because of a geopolitical problem. And what this is, essentially, to me, it seems, is a sort of long-standing, very angry geopolitical dispute that is being trussed up in sort of national security clothing because we feel more comfortable saying that rather than just coming out and saying this is actually, we dislike China. China flew a spy balloon over North America 2 months ago, and yeah, we think that that is a problem.
We just had a congressional hearing at which the CEO of TikTok sat in front of a congressional panel and took pretty much of a beating, it seemed to me. What did you think of that spectacle, Chris?
I thought it was reflective of a lot of the big tech hearings that we've seen in the past, but there was this added venom, I suppose, which I do think comes from that China connection. You know, we have diagnosed here the problem, which is that we share a lot of information on social media that we shouldn't, but we've kind of misdiagnosed it as China. And it was, I think it was disappointing as someone who has been, you know, kind of scrutinizing this company and this app for many, many years to try and find that smoking gun. And I'm not the world's best journalist, but I'm also far from the world's worst. And I was hoping to hear in this hearing some sort of evidence of that bat phone between Xi Jinping and ByteDance.
Did you hear any sense of expertise? I'm afraid this is the world's most leading question, but in the past, when you've seen congressional panels on social media, the level of cluelessness and ignorance, it was kind of stunning. Yeah. Sometimes endearing in a kind of grandparent-like way, but stunning. And did you see any difference this time around?
I wasted 5.5 hours of my life. there were lower lowlights than we have seen in previous tech hearings.
For example,
one congressman asking whether TikTok connected to his home Wi-Fi router, which yes, it does, because every single digital service that you use utilizes that. There were some interesting small chinks of light to be had in it. There was a line of questioning around the communications tool Lark, which is used on ByteDance's servers. Mm-hmm. But generally, this was a lot of heat and almost no light. In fact, I'd say it was kind of a total eclipse of knowledge. It was just the darkest thing I've ever seen.
Chris Stokel-Walker is the author of TikTok Boom. We'll be back in a moment with Evan Osnos, who's based in Washington and has reported extensively in China. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We're looking today at the politics of TikTok. Politicians on both sides of the aisle have expressed interest in banning the app or enforcing ByteDance to sell TikTok to a U.S.-based company. Now, the general suspicion about TikTok comes largely from a concern that Beijing could lean on ByteDance, which owns TikTok, to direct what videos get seen. Some polls worry that through TikTok, the Chinese could exert influence on political opinion in America, particularly among young people. Now, before the break, we heard from Chris Stokel-Walker, a British tech journalist, and we'll get back to Chris in a moment. But we're joined now by New Yorker staff writer Evan Osnos, and he's based in Washington. Evan, you lived for years in Beijing as a reporter for the Chicago Tribune and then for the New Yorker. Let's step back and look at the broader moment we're in with U.S.-China relations. You wrote a piece not too long ago called Sliding Toward a New Cold War, a very ominous piece. To what degree do you think the anti-TikTok sentiment is a symptom of a real hardening of anti-China positions in this country that's not limited to left or right or center?
It's quite striking, David, I have to say, as somebody who's kind of been studying and watching and reporting on the U.S.-China relationship for a couple of decades, to see how precipitous the change has been. I mean, in broad strokes, for 30 years from the time that Nixon went to China in 1972, all the way up until this period when, you know, there was this time in which American companies and American individuals and students basically believed that the future involved China for them. And there was this assumption that, look, China is in so many ways utterly different than we are. Its political system is authoritarian and not, it's not going to wake up tomorrow as a democracy, but that bit by bit, it was becoming a little bit more like us, quote unquote. And I think there's been this profound change. And it's really only happened since about maybe 2015. That's when you began to see it towards the end of the Obama administration. It became more acute during the Trump administration. In 2018, of course, the U.S. imposed tariffs on Chinese goods. China responded in kind. And so you had this trade war that signaled this new era. And the net effect is that today, as we're talking in 2023, the U.S.-China relationship is at its most deteriorated condition since 1972. I mean, there's just no other way to put it, David. It is at a really acute and in many ways dangerous moment because of growing tensions over Taiwan, over human rights abuses in China, over the way the United States has responded to these things and its own internal political chemistry. And I would add one other thing, which is that in some ways, TikTok arrived in Americans' lives in about 2018. It's just been about 5 minutes. And in some ways, it coincided with the same period of collapse in the U.S.-China relationship. And so they became
synonymous. So TikTok is a symbol, a symptom of a larger
exactly
problem.
And in a way, if you're a member of Congress, you look at TikTok and you say, this is the clearest emblem of my concern about China, and this is something I can talk about and touch.
Evan, what does it mean politically that Jamal Bowman, for example, or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez are among the members of Congress who think that banning TikTok is ridiculous? Is it because they're younger and use social media so prominently in their own political lives?
There's no question that they are in touch with that 150 million Americans who tend to be younger than the average voter. They are listening to their concerns, not only about access to an app, but also about what they would view as a kind of hypocrisy on some level. Mm-hmm. They'd say, well, why is it that we're going after this company, but not after Google and Facebook? I think that in some ways, China's decision to ban not just Twitter, but also Facebook and the New York Times mm-hmm. and a whole host of other foreign information sources it makes it actually that's in some ways the most credible piece of evidence to then take action on the U.S. side. If you're looking for an argument for why the U.S. can and should do something, you come down on the argument for reciprocity. You say, look, this is an imperfect solution, but as long as China is banning these kinds of American companies, why is it that we're going to allow them to have free reign here? And whether or not you think the final destination should be that everybody is banned, it forces a conversation on the Chinese side to say, well, why is it that you expect to have full access in the United States when you don't grant that the other way?
How do the Chinese rationalize that?
They don't have to. In a sense, what they say is, your system is yours and ours is ours.
We saw a real campaign by Chinese officials to defend TikTok, even as the company itself tries to distance itself from the Communist Party and the Chinese government. Is it possible to untangle that relationship?
I think the honest answer, David, is that it's impossible to untangle it. In the end, if you are a company in China, there is a point on the horizon, and you don't really know when it is, when they can come to you and say, now we want access to your data, or we want access to your executives, or we're going to put pressure on your leadership to do things that they might have committed publicly to not do. That's just the practical reality. And I think TikTok finds itself trying to come up with ways of segregating its relationship in the United States from its broader relationship in China. And that's just very difficult to do.
Chris, what would a TikTok ban actually look like?
I think it would be pretty significant. I think, again, we can look to prior precedent in India for kind of an example of how it would go, which is you would see homegrown alternatives trying to step up in its place. And that didn't really work in India because, frankly, those homegrown versions were developed so quickly in the aftermath of the ban that they just were imperfect copies. Handily, we do have two pretty well-formed, well-funded competitors, YouTube Shorts and Instagram Reels, two massive tech companies who are developing essentially TikTok-alikes, things that look pretty similar to TikTok and have been for several years as they've seen the rise of TikTok eat into their market share. It's also notable, actually, that a lot of this political maneuvering and wrangling comes off the back of lots of lobbying on behalf of Meta to say TikTok is a little bit of a risk here. So I think we can't overlook that.
Out of pure economic self-interest, you're suggesting.
Precisely, yeah. And I think that is interesting to think about. Whether or not those users of TikTok, those 150 million Americans, would port over their accounts to Instagram or to YouTube, I think, is yet to be decided.
Well, this is exactly the point. It's my experience, and maybe everybody's, that when people have something and they enjoy it and seem to use it 2 hours a day, as you're suggesting, which is an incredible number, 150 million people getting disappointed all at once is going to have political ramifications, isn't it, Evan?
I think there is a real political element here. Chris touched on something very important, which is the fact that the Facebooks and the Googles of the world have a really strong interest in actually seeing TikTok disappear. I think actually that in a way, the larger political question that isn't being talked about because people are focusing on China is the fact that we don't have a meaningful federal protection statute of any real kind that prevents ordinary people, whether they're kids or adults, from having their data collected and misused, whether it's by an American company or a Chinese company. And in some ways, that's the conversation that is necessary. I look at it partly through the lens of my own kids who are too small right now to be using it, but it's just a matter of time before I'm going to be sort of transposing my own neurosis about it onto them. And I do want to see us do something that would make the world a little safer for them. And some of that is our own behavior. And then some of that is also, ultimately, I think, asking regulators to do what we've done whenever there's a new technology that comes into our lives, whether it was automobiles, and saying, look, it's not that we're going to ban the automobile, but let's put seatbelts in them and figure out a way to make ourselves
safer. Chris, what would seatbelts be for TikTok? Or do you recoil from that sense of restriction?
I don't. I think that we need better regulation. I think the problem is that at the minute, with the sort of politicians that we have, the seatbelts would be made of silly string and kind of tied together with loose knots. And this is kind of the challenge. We do need regulation, but we're in this awkward flux period at the minute where, truthfully, we need to wait for older people to die and younger people to take their place. The AOCs of the world are not yet the decision makers that they need to be. And so if we have bad regulation enacted, this could set off a kind of series of chain reactions that could lead to the thing that we've kind of been avoiding for the entire history of the internet, which is we essentially run parallel splinter nets. Mm. You know, in the same way that China has a splinter net where you can access some services that are similar, but not all of them, we could run that same risk in the United States, which would be really catastrophic for not just users in the United States, but also for outreach to those in different parts of the world that we want to educate about our norms, our societies, our democracies.
Evan, why do you think this is such a bipartisan issue when bipartisanship is a vanishing phenomenon in American political life?
I think there is a way in which China and TikTok as a part of that has become almost a kind of source of relief for politicians because they're divided on absolutely everything. And yet here is this one topic.
We can all agree on TikTok and China.
Well, in a sense, that's how it seems. That's how it feels in the room. You know, if you watch, there's a set of hearings that have been going on with a select committee on China. And there is a certain degree of glee that you detect among the participants that they finally found something that pulls them together. And I think that, as a citizen, makes me a little bit uncomfortable because anytime we have too much of a consensus in Washington, an unexamined set of beliefs, that means that we're at risk of something. I think, you know, we're now talking about 20 years after the invasion of Iraq, and it's not too grand an analogy to make to say we need to be really vigilant as citizens, as journalists, to question what it is that the government is basing its assumptions off of. And one of the questions that's been asked is to say, I know that TikTok is vulnerable to the Chinese government's requests. We know that. That is a fair reading of the facts. But we also don't know exactly what it is that our government believes is possible and what is the risk. And oftentimes when you raise that question, the answer that comes back from people in the U.S. government is, well, if you had access to the information I have access to, the intelligence, then you would agree with my level of concern. But I think all of us have learned that that's not really a satisfying answer to any question.
In fact, it's often a disastrous answer to a question. Chris, in the U.K., are there similar concerns about TikTok, or is this a particularly American phenomenon?
No, this is a global issue now. And actually, it is multiple countries around the world, multiple jurisdictions following in the US's lead. So Canada has banned TikTok on government devices. The European Union has done a similar thing. The UK banned it on government devices. And then 8 minutes into the congressional hearing announced that they were banning the use of TikTok on the UK parliamentary estate. So that would be essentially the equivalent of banning it from any use on the Hill in the US. And what's interesting is each of these countries, and there are more, New Zealand, Australia, others, have kind of taken this approach of banning TikTok partially. They're not banning it countrywide, which is what the US seems to be trying to do, which will be interesting to see whether it holds. They've been choosing a sort of half measure. They're saying, we're going to focus this specifically on a very, very small proportion of users, government users. I mean, it seems almost like this is a way of signaling to the US that we are behind you while also not really poking the bear in a way of angering everyday users.
Chris, you're obviously very skeptical of a ban of TikTok. And it does seem that in trying to regulate social media, the government so often gets it wrong. What is the smart way to think about or deal with this problem?
I think we have to recognize that, you know, we have uniquely failed over the last 15, 20 years to get a grip on social media and tech more generally. You know, and we're so beyond being able to get a grip on them through any sort of regulation, whether it's in the US, whether it's in Europe or anywhere else, that they have to essentially self-police. And that doesn't always work. And we kind of see, you know, the excesses of that, particularly in how Twitter is spooling into a kind of odd death spiral right now, where the sort of conceit that, you know, the tech executives will be the grown-ups in the room, and we've kind of thought that they haven't been previously, has been shown that actually they're trying pretty well to do so with Elon Musk in comparison. So I think if we can't get that kind of federal data regulation, as Evan says, or any kind of antitrust level sort of crackdown on these big tech platforms, I think we need to kind of take ownership ourselves. We need to be much more cautious about what we share with these platforms. We need to monitor where our data is going.
So in practical terms, what would we have to change?
So you don't use your real name on social media. If you are really worried about these national security risks, which, you know, we have had previous concerns around TikTok being banned on army bases several years ago, and that is kind of a valid concern. But then also, if you're on an army base, don't record video on any social media platform, because people can glean information from that, from what they see in the background. Clean out your data regularly, for instance. You can reset your TikTok algorithm if you worry that it knows too much about you. Those are sorts of the things that we should be doing. But we should also, you know, not necessarily give up on the idea of regulating this officially. We should be asking our politicians to do better. We should be, you know, getting AOC like tech literate politicians. Ilhan Omar is a Twitch streamer, which is, you know, means that she has much more lived experience of this stuff and knows it innately more than anybody else who is kind of blustering from behind a pulpit in Congress.
I think the line of the day is, we have to wait for the old people to die. Thank you both. It was a terrific discussion.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Chris Stokel-Walker writes for Wired and other publications, and he's the author of TikTok Boom. Evan Osnos, of course, is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Donald Trump's first major campaign rally this time around took place in Waco, Texas, 30 years after the tragically botched raid by federal agents on an armed religious group. Since that raid, Waco has become a touchstone for extremists on the right, like Alex Jones. Rachel Monroe covers Texas and the Southwest for us, and she wrote about the mythology of grievance and conspiracy that the Waco raid has inspired. Rachel joined our podcast, The Political Scene, this week to talk about the 30th anniversary of Waco and what it's got to do with Donald Trump in 2024. That's on The Political Scene, a podcast from The New Yorker. And this is The New Yorker Radio Hour. We'll be back in just a moment. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. If you want to see some of the more extreme examples of liberally minded people bending themselves into pretzels to show that they're woke, you could tune into Fox News, which has a particular dedication to that theme. Or if you want a more comedic version of it, you could see The Thanksgiving Play, which opens on Broadway this week and has already been produced around the country. It's a play about the making of a play. The four performers struggle to devise a Thanksgiving play that is somehow respectful of Native peoples and historically accurate, but they also don't want to make the audience feel terrible about American history. And they want to make the performers themselves feel included in the process of writing it. If that sounds like a train wreck, well, that's what happens. The playwright is Larissa Fasthorse, and she belongs to the Sichangu Lakota Nation, and she's the first Native American woman with a play produced on Broadway.
I wanted to talk to Larissa not only because of the humor and the sharp wit and the sort of structural tightness that you find in her work, but also because she has become, just by dint of her identity, kind of a foremost voice about Native presence in the arts and how our artistic culture feeds into and is a consequence of the larger culture in a way that almost no one else working in America is today.
That's The New Yorker's Vincent Cunningham. He spoke the other day with Larissa Fasthorse.
I grew up in South Dakota, where my Lakota people are from. But I was adopted at a young age, an open adoption to a white family who had worked on the reservation for a long time, the reservation that I'm from. I was always raised very aware of my Lakota identity and my Lakota culture, mm-hmm. and they brought a lot of mentors into my life and elders to help me stay connected in that way. But at the same time, I was growing up in a very white culture. Sure. And my first career was in classical ballet, so it doesn't really get much whiter than that. I don't know, maybe opera, I'm not sure.
There's a list, but ballet is on the top.
They're way up there, yeah. They're always in the, like, top five. So, you know, at the time, when I was younger, it was very painful,
sure.
right, to be separated from a lot of things that I felt like I couldn't partake in because I wasn't raised on the reservation or I'd been away from my Lakota family so long. And that was very hard. But now, you know, I really recognize it as my superpower that I can take Lakota culture and experiences and contemporary Indigenous experiences and translate them into white audiences, which unfortunately are the majority of audiences still in American theater.
Yeah. So I do want to go back to this thing about ballet because it does seem like this really important part of your life that you are you're a professional ballet dancer. Mm-hmm. And how much did your training as a dancer, how much does that sort of stay with you? Is that a part of your approach as a writer? Do you think about that often when you're working?
Oh, yes. My ballet background is hugely influential in my work as a playwright. First off, just in the work ethic, ballet dancers are expected to be shown something once, and then you work on it on your own, and you come back, and you've got it down. Like, people aren't going to sit there and spend a lot of time
right.
spoon-feeding things or teaching you one thing at a time. You're expected to learn it. You're expected to do your own training at night after 6 hours of classes and rehearsal. You're expected to do a lot on your own, and that kind of work ethic certainly has helped me as a playwright, where you spend, you know, months sometimes alone in your home writing, and you could miss that deadline. No one's going to yell at you. but also, you can really see it in my writing. There's a lot of movement-based acting. I guess, text-free scenes in my work. Mm-hmm. The Thanksgiving play is a perfect example. There's several scenes that have little to no text that are movement-based, and they are moving the story forward and they're essential to the story, but without using text or very little text and a lot of movement and gesture. And then I'd say finally also, you know, as far as my process, I was trained primarily in the George Balanchine tradition. Mm-hmm. And his way of working with dancers and his choreography was to change it all the time, depending on who he was working with. So when I'm in the room with actors like I have been here in New York for the past couple months, I'm constantly adapting my work to that group of people. So it highlights their strengths and is perfect for them. So my work is always changing when I'm in the room.
So the Thanksgiving play, it's about four people who, let's say, present as white, trying to put on a play about the first Thanksgiving and sort of trying and I think often failing to acknowledge this Native presence that they are somehow trying to highlight. And I was thinking a lot about, let's say, what's happening in Florida, about, like, how we educate our children about topics that might make them feel, whatever, guilty or upset. How much of today's dramas over education and race and history were you thinking about with this new production?
Oh, a lot. I definitely have updated a lot for the times. It's interesting you mentioned Florida. The laws state if something causes, I think it's guilt, discomfort, or anguish based on your race, it can't be taught in a school, and you will you'll see those words in the play if you come to it. I wanted to make sure that these people, because they are, I call performative wokeness. You know, these are white folks, liberal folks, trying really hard to do everything right and, as you said, getting everything wrong. And I wanted to make sure that they're people of today and not someone who can look at, you know, I don't want people to be able to say, oh, well, since 2020 we've changed, so this isn't me, because it definitely still is.
Right.
But interestingly, one of my first writing mentors was the great Maritamita, who is a Maori writer and filmmaker from New Zealand, Aotearoa. And she said to me on my very first screenplay that I wrote before I was writing plays, she said, Larissa, you can be an artist or you can be an educator. Mm-hmm. If you try to be both, you'll do one of them badly. So you have to pick one. And I chose artist. And she said, there's certainly art that educates and there's education that's artistic. But you have to choose which one you are and stay true to that.
I mean, I imagine that that tension is exacerbated by the expectations of the audience, right? I mean, mm-hmm. just the way the arts happen in America, usually the audiences are white.
Right.
And they often, I think it's fair to say some people come to the theater on some level hoping to have some sort of educational experience as mm-hmm. opposed to art. So it's like, what I love about your play is that it's like, no, you're just going to laugh and it's going to feel weird. And is that something that you like to play with, or is it something that feels like a hurdle?
No, absolutely. No, I love that.
One thing I love about this play, there's a character named Alicia, and she's played by Darcy Carden, a very funny, wonderful performer. And she's hired on the assumption that she is a Native person.
Right.
And I thought about this because a lot of the literature that I was raised on, Black literature, passing is a big theme. What does passing mean to you on stage and off?
You know, I'm white passing in many ways. And yet at the same time, before I was writing, when I was acting for a while, mm-hmm. and the casting director said to me, we can tell you're not completely white, and that's a problem. And I was like, wow. Jeez. Well, and I was like, okay, I'm done. Yeah. There's nothing I can do about that.
Yeah. Is that America's subtitle? Is that perhaps the whole thing?
Yes, yeah, that should be a little subtitle underneath. United States of America, we can tell you're not white. That's a problem. so it was, but I am very light-skinned. And again, it was something that was sometimes painful because colorism, you know, is a thing in our communities. And it was sometimes painful that I was so light and white passing growing up with a lot of, you know, full blood. I mean, my father is full blood and they're much darker, my biological father. And so I had some pain over that growing up. And especially because then I was raised away from it. It's like, who are you, you know, showing up again? However, then on the other side, on the white side, which is like American theater, I am quite sure that I get into rooms that not white passing Native people would not get into.
Yeah. It's funny. The other thing about Alicia is that she's brought in, you know, specifically and like not just to be an actorly presence, but it's like, we're going to use her expertise and we're going to what do you have to say? Please tell us, you know.
The wisdom.
I would imagine that that has some corollary to your experience.
Oh, it's exhausting. I would say, I just can't imagine what it would be like to just, like, for a white male playwright. Like, they just walk into a theater and they're just a playwright and they don't do anything else. Yeah. Like, I can't imagine what that's like. I've never done it. Because, you know, I mean, I'm so fortunate with the career I've had, but I'm also the first one in 90% of the places I've worked. Like, the first one in this theater, first one in, you know, it just goes on every, I've got six shows this year, and it's like, most of them, I'm the first Native American, right? I guess this is, you know, the privilege of being the first means that I also have a responsibility. I do what I call Indian 101 that all of the staff has to come to, including front of house, box office, production, everybody, to help them understand Indigenous culture, the space they're standing in, and most importantly, our audiences that we're hoping to welcome into the theater and how do we welcome them and understanding that theater is a white culture. Western American theater is a white culture. You know, the assumptions you're making of what's acceptable behavior in theater is completely different than what is normal behavior in so many cultures in this continent.
So. One of the great things about the Thanksgiving play is that it spotlights so many things about theater that present to us as issues and actually say, well, do we really mean that? And I think we've all settled into an orthodoxy, let's say, of like, you can't play outside of your race and ethnicity, whatever, your look. But of course, what that means is if there aren't Indigenous roles to play, Indigenous actors are never able to do that act of representation. In your experience, just working with actors and stuff, how have people started to think about that?
So that's interesting because actually casting is still very complicated.
Yeah.
Red Face is being done regularly all over our country, on film and TV, on stages. There's so many non-Indigenous actors still playing Indigenous roles. And there's so many people calling themselves Indigenous that cannot in any way prove they're Indigenous and have no actual connection to any Indigenous community playing Indigenous roles.
Right.
People say they understand more and they're doing better, and yet there they are. Red Face is being done constantly. Conversely, fascinatingly, if you read the script of the Thanksgiving play, I put in the character description that people of color who can pass for white should be considered for roles.
Right.
And I was really proud of that. But when I get to New York, we were told we can't put that in the casting breakdown. Well, you can't ask people to play someone else. I was like, wait, there are still white people on these stages in New York City right now playing native. This was a few years ago, playing native. But you're saying I can't openly have white people play white people if they look white to you, you know? And they're like, no, you absolutely can't. I'm not allowed to ask people if they're Native American when they're being cast. And so we have to do this whole kind of song and dance of I kind of try to figure it out by chit-chat and seeing, like, and then people get all mad because we cast someone that turns out they weren't Native or they didn't have a connection to the community. And it's this constant, like, thing, which is all part of, you know, what we're dealing with in Thanksgiving play.
Well, yeah, I mean, one way of interpreting the show is that it's about the sort of the most far-reaching implications of meaning well. It seems to me that the people that are going to, that come to Broadway shows are, like, these same well-meaning people. I don't know. What has been the response to that? This is kind of you. What, you know, how do you feel about that?
Oh, it's absolutely you. I mean, no, like, I do not hide that. I don't hide the fact that this is about, you know, white liberal folks, which tend to be theater goers, not all. I mean, I think the thing that I keep saying, but it's been very important to me in this play, was that first, it's fun and that you get to have a good time in the theater. And second, I would say that's the sugar, and then there's the medicine.
Yeah.
And so it's satire. It's a comedy within a satire. So the satire is the medicine, and you have to keep taking it through it. And, you know, honestly, some people opt out. We've had a couple people walk out. And,
really?
And, like, once it got too far in, they were just like, no, this is too much. And
I can imagine at least one scene where that might happen.
Yeah. But, you know, the vast majority of audiences are really raucously responsive and really having a fun time. Last week, we had audience members talking to the stage, like talking back. And, I mean, it just got wild. They added like 6, 7, 8 minutes to the show.
Whoa.
Yeah, it was crazy.
That's a lot of talking.
It was a lot of talking and chatting and clapping and, you know, responding. And, like, we love that.
Something that I've wondered, because I think most people who live on Manhattan— think about the Lenape only usually before a show or something, and then someone comes out and does a land acknowledgement and say, this is the land of the Lenape people, and they say, like, this thing. Is that practice? How do you feel about that practice?
Yeah, I mean, land acknowledgement, honestly, I know in some places we're getting a little tired of it, but I will say it's definitely... It's not everywhere, and it's not all facets of the society. So I'd say, you know, for me, until everybody in the United States of America can name the indigenous land they're standing on, we need to keep doing it.
Good, yeah.
But, you know, I always say, too, though, land acknowledgement is a step. So it's the first step of many steps toward reparation, right? Or the many steps of reparation.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't name who you're supposed to be paying reparation to, you obviously can't even begin. So you have to at least know who reparations are owed to for the land that you're on. Who are you paying rent to? You know, you need to know that. And then you need to start paying the rent.
Thank you so much for doing this.
Of course. Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's so much fun.
The New Yorker's Vincent Cunningham speaking with playwright Larissa Fasthorse. The Thanksgiving play is in previews for its Broadway run. And it opens next week. I'm David Remnick. That's our program for today. Thanks so much, and see you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbes of Toon Yards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Max Balton, Rita Green, Adam Howard, Kalalia, Avery Keatley, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, Louis Mitchell, and Gofen Mputubwele, with guidance from Emily Botine and assistance from Harrison Keithline, Michael May, David Gable, Amy Pearl, Meher Bhatia, and Alejandra Deshe. And special thanks this week to Alex Barron. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.